Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up today. First, in a few minutes, Enrique Diaz, chief strategist for eBerry Partners, discusses the economic and political crisis in his home country, Spain. And then Michael Dorsey, a professor of environmental studies at Dartmouth, discusses the recent Rio Plus 20 UN conference on sustainable development. Just a couple of quick comments in the news. First, on July 10, the Wall Street Journal published a story on political spending by American unions. It went beyond the usual reports to the Federal Election Commission and looked instead at the much broader documents that unions must file with the Department of Labor. If only business and other interest groups are required to file such revealing documents. The Journal's research showed that between 2005 and 2011, unions spent $4.4 billion in political contributions, get-out-the-vote work, lobbying and such, four times as much as previously thought. The SEIU alone spent $750 million. And what in God's name do they have to show for all this? What influence over policy have they gained for having spent this kind of cash and human effort? I can't think of any. As I've said before, if unions had devoted resources on this scale to pushing for single payer instead of supporting the campaigns of Democratic hacks who end up ignoring or betraying them once in office, this would be a much better country. And now, just a few words on the LIBOR scandal, the revelation that big banks in London conspire to fix an important interest rate that is the basis for many other financial instruments. Enrique Diaz will have more to say about this later in the show. Yes, it smells bad, but it's really hard to say who the victims were. Maybe some institutional investors? But it's nothing next to the other financial scandals of recent years. Yet it's provoked lots of outrage. I do wonder if it's gotten this much attention because some of the possible victims, if they're really victims, were institutional investors and not elderly black homeowners in Queens. My first guest is Enrique Diaz, chief strategist for eBerry Partners, a foreign exchange firm. Previously, Enrique has been a trader with several hedge funds, even though his academic background is in electrical engineering. Despite his employment in finance, Enrique is a good guy with good politics and a smart take on the world. Though he lives in New York now, Enrique is originally from Spain and follows events in that country closely, so he's a perfect guest to talk about the economic crisis there, as well as the popular upsurge we've seen lately, with miners on strike and a mass demonstration in Madrid in their support just the other day. Enrique Diaz. Welcome, Enrique. Before we talk about the Spanish economic crisis, which just keeps going on and on, a few words about the demonstrations we've seen in the last few days. Miners striking rather dramatically, and then a giant march in Madrid on Tuesday. What do you make of it?
Well, miners in particular have been among the most activist and organized parts of the Spanish working class since forever. Spain has a highly subsidized mining sector. Spanish coal is considerably more expensive to get off the ground than say, importing Polish coal or coal from elsewhere in the world. It's also a very dirty energy. And the miners' activity is highly dependent on the level of subsidies and guarantees. That's a little bit of the background, which means that any move from the Spanish government to reduce those subsidies immediately translates in job losses. And there's entire communities, particularly in Asturias and Aragon, that depend completely on these highly subsidized mining operations. The demonstrations, I think they're part of a tradition where in Spain, highly organized sectors of the working class do not generally take layoffs laying down. They organize these moderate disruptions, or sometimes not so moderate disruptions, of public order. And generally, the goal is to not so much reverse the policy of shutting down these loss-making enterprises, but at least obtain a better deal than they would have otherwise. My guess is that this is going to be a little more difficult because the Spanish sovereign, for obvious reasons, is not in a condition to offer as generous a deal as they typically used to offer. When this entire Spanish shipbuilding industry, steelmaking industry, all of it loss-making in the 80s was shut down. Workers were typically sent home after considerable violence in the street. Workers were sent home with 80% of pay until retirement. That is unlikely to happen now, and that's why I think there's a chance that this this sort of demonstration will be more violent and less controlled than it was before. But to summarize, this type of demonstration is nothing new in Spain, and I would not really necessarily think that there's a strong tie between what's going on now and the crisis.
And there have been many demonstrations since Spain entered this crisis,
yes.
And they've had minimal effect on the austerity plans, right?
Yes, the demonstrations have always been peaceful, with one exception in Barcelona, where the members of the Catalan Parliament had to enter the building in a helicopter. And clearly, peaceful demonstrations, even by hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, do not seem to have no effect. In fact, the Conservative Party that won the election in November, overwhelmingly, he got a true democratic mandate, has had to reverse pretty much every promise that he made during the electoral campaign in the first 6 months, and according to the polls, they would still win the election if he were held today. So I think that the thing to understand about Spain is that having 200,000 people in the street is far less meaningful than it would be in the United States, where people just do not have that tradition of demonstration.
And let's then talk about the economic crisis. I guess that a lot of folks who are listening don't really understand how Spain got into such trouble in the first place. So give us the prehistory of crisis.
Yeah, ever since the 80s, where Spain closed down the remnants of the state-led development industry in heavy industry, steel, shipyards, mining, etc., the Spanish economic model has had two main engines. One of them is help from the rest of Europe, mostly in terms of subsidies and convergent funds that amounted to 1-2% of GDP a year, and more importantly, construction. Spain is a real estate obsessed country. The number of houses built per household, I think, is the highest in the world. People regard empty apartments as the best repository of wealth, and so it came to pass that by the mid-2000s, Spain was building more houses every year than France and the United Kingdom combined. This was enabled by the fact that once it joined the euro, German and Northern European financial institutions thought that a riskless way to dispose and invest their surplus would be to finance Spanish banks, which in turn financed this massive boom. So when the bubble broke everywhere else, a series of credit bubbles and housing bubbles broke, Spain found itself with a public sector that, thanks to the bubble, had very little debt, one of the lowest debts per GDP in Europe, but a massively indebted private sector, especially through banks.
And that was mostly residential mortgages?
Mostly residential mortgages, effectively, yes. Then, the inability of Spanish regulators to grapple with the bubble is nothing different from what happened everywhere else in the world. What has been a little bit idiosyncratic about Spain has been the response to the cracking of the bubble. Spain regulators, the government, the banks, everybody made a concerted effort starting in 2008 to deny the crisis, to deny that there was a bubble, and to delay the adjustment. So I think that last time we talked, if it was late last year, we talked about how the Spanish real estate market, and let's say the American real estate market or the Irish real estate market, have not corrected. Prices were still extremely high, and what you had obviously was what you have in these cases when markets are not allowed to clear. You have very high prices for those who have to, for whatever reason, purchase a house, and a massive surplus of empty housing and stock waiting to be sold.
And people were able to continue to service mortgages during the initial phases of the crisis?
Yes. The reason is that the Spanish mortgages, bankruptcy law for consumers is non-existent. The laws are truly draconian. Walking away from your mortgage means that the bank can pursue you for the rest of your life. There's no such thing as bankruptcy. And the government will garnish every money you make over, I think the limit is about 700 euros a month, and hand it over to the banks. So the only way to stop paying your mortgage is to go into the underground economy until you die. So people make, so far, the hole in the Spanish balance sheets comes from constructors who have the no compulsion. The promoters, the developers, they can walk away from the messes that they made, from the new construction that is not being sold, which usually finance and not using the personal guarantee of the constructor, but rather a company's guarantee. So right now, nearly all of the hole in the Spanish balance sheets comes from developers who walked away from semi-finished or finished but not sold housing. Mortgages, as unemployment rises, mortgages are starting to become a problem. However, people will make every effort to pay the mortgages. Family ties are stronger, and I know personally of a couple of people who are having their parents pay the mortgage for them. So the draconian Spanish laws vis-a-vis consumer bankruptcy are keeping that part of the bank's balance sheet in relatively good shape, considering the disaster.
It's interesting contrast with Iceland, where they wrote off a lot of debts above a certain amount and have engineered a rather decent recovery, but not for Spain.
Indeed. Spain, in fact, has been the poster child of following to the T German orders. German and European orders, they have acknowledged so in several occasions, and that's why we've had a bit of a, I think insufficient, but a bit of a special treatment. Spain is acknowledged to be the poster child of vigorous implementation of austerity measures, and in fact, I don't know if you saw the paper, but today Rajoy went back on yet another bunch of electoral promises that he was making up until 2 weeks ago. VAT rate is going up to 21%. Unemployment insurance is going to be cut. Unemployment payments are going to be cut after the first 6 months. Of course, civil workers get another basically 8% cut, which is something that happens almost quarterly by now. Funny enough, though, the one austerity measure that has overwhelming consensus of anybody from Keynesians to Friedmanites to anybody, which is doing away with the damaging mortgage deduction, generous mortgage deduction that encourages people to borrow money and buy houses, and when they don't pay a mortgage, buy another house and keep it empty. That stays in the books.
Why is that?
I think that many people, including myself, have severely underestimated the enormous political power of not just the construction sector, but the psychological hold of real estate investment among the Spanish upper and upper middle classes. It is something fantastic, and it's, I don't want to get too personal here, but when I talk to my relatives and my friends and the absolutely insane things they do, in terms of borrowing to buy apartments so that they can keep it empty and wait for the price to go up, I have never seen anything like that in the United States, even at the worst levels of the bubble.
And the transformation material reality has not yet transformed consciousness?
No, not yet. Other than perhaps Japan, this unique effort to pretend that the crisis wasn't happening. The freezing of the real estate market. You have the biggest real estate companies in Spain right now are the banks. The banks have inherited this, I think, it's very difficult to get figures, but on the order of a million or more, which will be the equivalent of 7 to 8 million in the United States, newly built empty apartments from the developers that have gone under. So they basically transformed themselves into real estate companies, and up till now, they have kept a highly cartelized market where no bank dropped the prices on the apartments they were trying to sell. And they had that market power because, you know, most people in order to buy an apartment need to get a mortgage. And you can only get a mortgage if you're going to take an apartment off the balance sheet of a bank. So I'm sorry to go into so much detail about the real estate situation, but if in order to understand the idiosyncrasies of Spain within the European crisis, the extraordinary psychological fixation, which is amounts to a national pathology with real estate, and by real estate I mean empty apartments as repositories of wealth, it's very difficult to understand the Spanish economy without making constant reference to that and how little progress has been made in fixing it.
Asuka Enrique Diaz, who is the head strategist for Iberia Partners. So what has the economic fallout been so far, economic contraction and unemployment?
Well, as probably everybody knows, unemployment is horrendously high. It's 24% now overall. Youth unemployment is over 50%. And the biggest problem with economic fallout is that the difference between this crisis and previous crisis, as it's 94, is the previous crisis was solved through the devaluation of the currency. Now, devaluing the currency is a blunt way of distributing the pain of past overconsumption and the need to restructure the economy, which is real. But currency devaluations distribute that pain suddenly and more or less equitably. In fact, if anything, owners of capital tend to suffer more. People with savings, with high net worths, tend to suffer more than workers because workers' pay tends to be indexed with inflation. So we're trying to, Spain is trying under German auspices to perform something like that, some internal devaluation to bring our costs in line with what they should be in order to be competitive without a currency devaluation. And it's whether
internal devaluation is the euphemism for deep wage cuts and just savaging of the job market.
True. I would say something in favor of consensus euphemism is that it's not only that. In Spain, for instance, going back to real estate costs, a true currency, internal devaluation would involve a, say, two-third cuts in rents and prices of houses, which would mean that the consumption basket for the average worker would go in price down dramatically. So that's what I'm going, that cutting wages is part of it, but Spain has all these built-in costs that are translated into the wage bill, that mostly real estate, that are completely out of line, that should have been cut dramatically, taking advantage of the bursting of the bubble, and have not.
But so far there have been political obstacles to getting that done.
Yes. And even the cutting of the wage bill, the problem is that the pain has been distributed, unlike the currency devaluation that distributes the pain fairly evenly across classes and across economic sectors, which are sometimes as important as social classes. The attempt to devalue internally means that those in a weaker position of power, without pricing power, without bargaining power, in this case, mostly low-skilled workers and the young, there's an important generational distribution to the pain, have borne nearly all of the pain, while a significant fraction of the workforce has borne no pain whatsoever. People who work in banking, the dramatically oversized Spanish banking system has not really started cutting headcount. My friend, who's an executive at one of the least ill Spanish banks, tells me that last year, that the last time they paid bonuses, the bonuses were less than 5% down from the previous year, which was a record. So this internal devaluation has been carried out very sloppily. Every sector of society has suffered or not according to the political power that they had, both in terms of different classes and different economic sectors. And when it comes to analyzing whether the economic pain has been worth the progress in restructuring the Spanish economy, the answer is no, because there has been no progress in restructuring the Spanish economy.
So this explains why there's been really so little political resistance to the austerity.
I believe so. I think it partly explains it, because the when I say the weaker sectors include government workers, which I would have never thought of them as a weak sector lacking in bargaining power. But so right now you have the lower skilled workers, the younger workers, civil servants, the three sectors that have borne the brunt of the Spanish austerity measures. I believe that there's more to that than just weakness and bargaining power. There's a certain surprising acceptance that this is the correct thing to do, even among people who are in the receiving end, which I find hard to explain.
We'll have to call it a psychoanalyst for that.
This is not an argument I'm comfortable making, because this is really not my area of expertise. I would much rather deal with numbers, macros, percentages, and at most class power. But when it comes to applying psychoanalysis to economic policy, I'm a bit of a loss, but I can't find any other explanation.
Now, normally, Spain, not a small country, but it's normally not one thought of as a country with global effects. But
right.
Obviously, Spain is now at the center of the European economic crisis, which is at the center of the world crisis.
Yes.
What about the European response to this crisis? I mean, the European authorities seem to, they have a summit every few weeks and issue a press release. The markets rally for about 5 minutes, and then it's back into crisis mode. What do you make of the European response to this kind of rolling crisis across Europe?
First, you know, to be pessimistic, I have to say when they first started getting these summits, this aquelarres, as we say in Spain, of finance ministers, I honestly thought that they must have some information that I didn't, because the numbers and the proposals and the programs that came out of it had no sense. They made no sense. I mean, you had the thing where Greece would cut its budget deficit by 7% this year, and then next year they would be growing by, the economy would be growing at 4%. Ridiculous things like that.
Do some of them at some level believe that austerity can be stimulative, or are they just patching things together and trying to get through to the next week?
I think at first they did. And at first, hey, when you first try a policy that is completely new, nobody knows. Maybe you're right. But that argument only works for the first 6 months. When six months later you're back not to the same spot but a far worse position, and you increase you tighten the austerity screws, and then 6 months later you're in a worse position. Clearly, it's very difficult for me to believe that they think that this is the right thing to do. But then again, it's very difficult to get into the minds of Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, and I'd rather, frankly, I'm not sure that's something that I would enjoy doing. But I have to be a little optimistic for once. I think that the latest summit did have some timid steps in the right direction. Not so much whether Spain got 30 billion euros or 100 billion euros for the banks, but in the sense that there seems to be a dawning realization of what the problem is. And I think that the fact that Europe is going to essentially eat at least part of the losses of Spanish banks without asking the Spanish sovereign to do it.
Europe, which means Germany and a few other smaller Germanic-type countries.
Sure. Spain also is kind of funny, because Spain also participates in this bailout fund that is supposed to bail out the Spanish. But, it's the northern countries. The fact that after all this bickering and that seems to be the case is a timid step in the right direction.
If they'd done this 2 years ago, things wouldn't have gotten to this pass, would they?
They wouldn't. However, 2 years ago, I think Spain has a lot of responsibility there, because the regulator, as I said, connived with the banking system into allowing them to hide the problems under the table, hoping that somehow, it was a little bit Mr. McCover from Dickens, hoping that something would turn up. And that has been the Spanish and European response to the crisis all along. So 2 years ago, Spanish banks were publishing record profits and paying out record bonuses, in spite of the fact that they were already broke by then, it would have been politically impossible for the European Union to do what it did now. So in this case, I have to say that the responsibility is shared between the Spanish authorities and the European authorities. Yeah. Now, I think that it's a really good step in the right direction, because it's transfer of sovereignty. Over regulatory sovereignty and some monitoring sovereignty, which is very important. Spanish figures have never been reliable. Spanish banking numbers have been ridiculous. So the fact that that's moved to is going to move away from Spain is actually a positive, and it's something that is extremely popular in Spain. Spanish, obviously not the Spanish elite, but the Spanish population is more than happy to. There's such a backlash against the Spanish politicians, regulators, bankers, and all elite that having all this stuff done by the Germans is actually a plus for Spain at this point. I think in this sense, Spain is different from Greece. So the quid pro quo of losing sovereignty in return for a real bailout, which for the first time has been mooted at this European summit, is a step in the right direction. Of course, the Germans are Germans, and they also attach yet another round of austerity conditions to it, which we are seeing the results today with this new package of wage cuts and tax increases in Spain.
So we've got Enrique Diaz, who is a head strategist with Iberia Partners. I know you said you didn't want to get too close to the mind of Wolfgang Schäuble, but how do you read German motivations?
I paid a lot of attention to Yanis Varoufakis, who you had a few weeks back, and his explanation for this apparently disastrous response on the part of Germany and shooting themselves in the foot actually makes sense within the context of Germany pursuing its economic interests. I am skeptical because the one thing I expected when the crisis started is that we would see some significant change of corporate control across Europe, some cross-border mergers, and to be blunt, German takeover of the commanding heights of the Spanish economy, which is still a lot easier to do than the United States, because in between the banks, the cajas, Telefónica and a few utilities.
Because they're like savings banks here.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I sort of assume everybody's familiar with the name of the boxes. It's Telefónica and the utilities are a far more important part of the Spanish economy than any such subset within the United States. The fact that since the crisis started, and in spite of dramatically low valuation for these Spanish companies, we have not seen a single German utility buy a Spanish utility. We haven't seen Deutsche Bank come out and buy one of the least broke Spanish banks, for instance. That makes me skeptical of any claim that Germany is hard in pursuing its economic interest for dominance in Europe in a hard-nosed way. If they were doing that, that would be the most visible aspect of that, I think, clearly. And we haven't seen any of that, not one, not in Spain, not in Italy, no changes of control cross-border everywhere. In fact, it's a very worrisome consequence of the crisis that finance and corporate governance is becoming more and more national and less European as the crisis goes.
Yeah, Yanis argues, has in several interviews I've done with him over the years, that the initial architects of the euro were aware that the lack of political institutions across the continent would hinder any response to a crisis, but that a crisis which was likely would spur their development.
And they had a point, clearly.
But it's not really happened with much.
It's happening, it's happening 2 years behind the disaster, and the question is whether it's happening too late. Essentially, some basic sensible measure as having a joint European Union banking regulator, since you have a joint currency and a joint interest rate policy, almost an obvious thing to have from a point of view of sustainability of the system, had to wait until Spain admitted that its banks were bankrupt. And Spain waited until Bankia basically was about to run out of money before they admitted that. So, yes, I can see that. Yes, it was not a ridiculous position to take on the part of the architects of the euro, say, well, there will be crisis, but crisis will force the European integration. I just think they seriously underestimated the resistance to European integration, not so much on the part of nationalist populations, which are, I think, a lot more easy to circumvent than people think, but on the part of the local elites and their reluctance to cede power to Brussels and Frankfurt.
We're running low on time, so just a little prognostication. Do you see the crisis spreading into Italy and just the eventual implosion of the whole Eurozone? How do you see this playing out?
I'm very pessimistic. I'm a little less pessimistic than I was before the summit, because at least, as I said, there's a downward realization of what the problem is. But at this point, the only thing that I think can turn things around is a significant demand expansion program, which has to come from the northern countries. I see no sign that is in the works, and until that happens, I think that this liquidity crisis that we've had over the last 2 years will be patched over, and it's morphing into a solvency crisis at the level of the sovereigns. And it'll be more drawn out, it'll be slower and less dramatic, but clearly with 25% unemployment and an economy that may or may not grow in 2014, the households, corporations, and sovereigns of Spain are not solvent entities.
Now, of course, Greece is in some sense, from the cynical point of view, expendable. It's a small country without much impact in the world outside it. But Spain is much larger and Italy is larger still. I mean, are these countries just too big to fail and the Germans just can't let it go?
They're too big to fail, not only from the point of view of Europe, but from the point of view of the world global economy. I worked a lot with bankers, traders, and the level of interconnection between sovereigns and banks in terms of sovereigns. The Barcelona subway having all these massive derivative positions with Unicredit or things like that, it's no different than it was under Lehman. I think that any significant non-payment by a sovereign, other than perhaps Greece, is going to have catastrophic consequences for world finance.
And then finally, to change the subject somewhat, any thoughts on the LIBOR scandal?
Well, I was in the middle of it back then, and frankly, everybody knew what was going on. nobody thought it was a big deal, just to give you an idea of what the mentality that if everybody did it, then it had to be, it was okay. It was very pervasive. And I think that it really heralds a serious change in terms of the political fortunes of the banking industry. It's something that was, according to everybody that was involved back then, not a big deal and well known, and nobody who even worked in the industry did not know about it, is causing these dramatic consequences, these record fines, these lawsuits, the actual loss of jobs of high ranking bankers for the first time since the crisis started. I think that I've been surprised by it. I did not expect such a sudden change in the political fortunes.
It's interesting,
the
different set of victims from the previous crisis, though.
The victims is everybody, and it's not clear whether overall the world was made worse or better off by people faking the LIBOR rate up 10 basis points or down 10 basis points, because for every winner there was a loser. So the fact that it's a scandal where the social losses are very difficult to actually measure and discern, and yet is having such enormous consequences, tells me that there's been a sea change in the political power of the banking sector.
Is this just the last straw after so many previous straws?
It could be, or maybe just somebody had it in for Diamond in the Bank of England. That's a good explanation. We'll see how many more people go down.
That was Enrique Diaz, Chief Strategy for eBury Partners, a London-based foreign exchange firm. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk about the Sustainable Development Conference that was held in Rio the other week. That was some of Cast No Shadows, a Mekong song from about a dozen years ago. The tone of understated apocalypse seemed like a good one to set up my next segment, an interview with Michael Dorsey, professor of environmental studies at Dartmouth College, who attended the UN's Rio Plus 20 Conference on Sustainable Development held a couple of weeks ago. Michael Dorsey. Welcome, Michael. You were at Rio Plus 20. We didn't really get much coverage of it up here. So tell us, first of all, what's the Plus 20 mean?
Well, Rio Plus 20 is the conference that takes place, or rather that took place, 20 years after the first Earth Summit, which was in 1992. So just last week in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, we had the United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development, which essentially was a 20-year look back since we were at the Earth Summit in 1992, also in Brazil, in Rio.
And it sounds like things did not go swimmingly at this conference.
Unfortunately, in terms of the formal negotiations, in terms of the outcomes of the conference, again, it was another disappointment, another lackluster showing, not just by the wealthy countries in the world, but also by many of the countries on the margins that are coming into power now. Even the Brazilian environment minister expressed her disappointment with the final outcomes because they lacked ambition, they lacked clear, meaningful decisions. Much was left to be desired in the final text and final outcomes.
Okay, so what were the hopes for this thing? I mean, the last climate conference was somewhat disappointing as well. So what hopes had been built up for this?
Well, we do have a kind of growing track record of failed multilateral processes. This process, the United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development, wasn't exactly following on the climate process formally. It was looking back, as I said, on the past two decades of thinking about how to deliver sustainable development. The desired goals as we came into the meeting were essentially around a handful of things. There was an effort to attempt to map a pathway towards what some of the diplomats have called the green economy, to rethink the economic system as we know it, to begin to include environmental degradation and protection into how we measure GDP. There was also an effort and a hope to develop a new set of agencies to manage environmental issues at the global level. And there was a hope that a new set of indicators that are called the Sustainable Development Goals would be defined and would basically ultimately take the place of what's called the Millennium Development Goals, which are a set of targets to deliver on environment and development issues and goals going forward. Unfortunately, we didn't see big commitments in terms of resources, in terms of institutions on any of those issues. We saw the member states, the countries that are involved in negotiations, all the world's countries that participate in the United Nations, we saw them indicate that they would like to agree on something, would like to do something going forward, but they didn't really make strong commitments on those big issues.
Well, it seems like Europe is in the midst of an economic crisis. The United States economy is not doing very well, and we're in the midst of an election season. Where was any leadership going to come from for this?
Well, there was hope, particularly by many U.S. NGOs, non-governmental organizations, environmental groups, and so forth, that the president, President Obama, would appear. Unfortunately, he opted not to, and he sent Secretary Clinton to the meeting. He was, just a few days before, in Mexico at the G20 negotiations. And unfortunately, the U.S., they didn't make real commitments. Probably the largest or one of the largest commitments that they announced in Rio was roughly $24 million that they were going to intend to commit to African countries to support their efforts to deliver on renewable energies. But that commitment was somewhat contradictory because just a few days before they made that announcement in Rio, they made it last Friday in Rio at the closing day of the conference. The Wednesday before they made the announcement in Rio, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, where the monies will be funneled through, announced that it was giving double that amount of money to the World Bank for basically large corporate energy-driven projects. So even though they make some minor commitments to small-scale renewable energy, they're still making double and more to large-scale old fossil fuel technology. So there's lots to be done, at least from leadership from the U.S. But I think the real leadership, again, and we saw this at the last climate negotiations, we've been seeing this a lot in multilateral negotiations, when governments fail to deliver and fail to make meaningful commitments, fail to move considerable resources, fail to come up with plans and pathways to get out of bad things like continuing to invest in fossil fuels, which drive the unfolding climate catastrophe. When we see that consistent behavior, consistent failed leadership by governments, we see social movements and environmental organizations and social justice organizations collaborating and working together to continue to put pressure on the particular governments, but also they collaborate and work together in the sort of the perimeters of these meetings to commit to doing projects together, commit to pressuring their governments, not just nationally, but also globally within these fora and within other multilateral, bilateral fora. So that continued movement and pressure from social movements, from environmental groups, from social justice groups, continues. And it's, I think, redefining activism as we know it, because real visionary ideas are coming from social movements, some of whom work with some progressive governments, but for the most part, they're delivering change through keeping up pressure on governments and fighting that way.
Yeah, I was about to ask whether one should be cynical about this whole process, since nothing seems to come out of it but a lot of hot air, which only worsens the climate problem. But are these meetings really useful in the sense that they create these networks among social movement actors, even if the states themselves are badly lagging?
Well, some of your colleagues, some journalists have been increasingly making this point of, you know, questioning the value of these meetings. The fact is that the world's governments will continue to meet forever, and they have to because they do have to coordinate a variety of policies, economic policies, social policies, environmental policies. The extent to which they take visionary decisions on those policies remains to be seen, and actually the past few years has been extremely lacking in terms of climate change, in terms of a whole host of concerns. But one of the things that social movement organizations do, environmental groups and social justice groups do, is they not only keep pressure on governments in these meetings to attempt to deliver more ambitious outcomes and goals, but they continue to expose the kind of corrupt, lackluster leadership And that's absolutely critical. So in a sense, there is a kind of bearing witness that is going on when organizations, non-governmental organizations, show up at these meetings. So it's not actually worthless, their continued participation, because someone has to make sure that the fox, that's oftentimes in the form of the head of a foreign ministry, or in our case, the head of the State Department, Secretary Clinton, the fox doesn't raid the environmental or social or economic henhouse. And we know that the way government is currently configured is oftentimes government is in cahoots with big finance, and the only ones that can expose that are organizations committed to environmental justice, social justice, and so forth. And that's really the role of many of these organizations in these meetings, keeping governments honest, keeping a bright light shine on the dirty deals that get made between governments and finance. And that's a good thing.
So, speaking of dirty deals, I guess there are some special kinds of NGOs at this conference, corporations. What kind of actors are they at these events?
Yeah, that's actually right. I mean, technically speaking, a non-government organization, most people think of it as a nice, warm and fuzzy environmental group. But really, a non-government organization is any organization that is not a government organization, and that includes corporations, even though corporations maintain very tight relationships with governments for a variety of reasons. Particularly in the past several years, many of the finance companies looking for bailouts from governments as they played quick and fast and dirty with their own reserves. So there have been several configurations in the orbit of these various meetings. At the climate meetings, we see the International Emissions Trading Association as being very, very prevalent in lobbying governments and pushing for more resources for various projects like carbon trading projects. At the past meeting in Rio, this UN Conference on Sustainable Development, we saw the formation of, we saw the World Business Council and the Business Action for Sustainable Development, which are two large international networks of business organizations that come together, again, to present ostensibly what they're doing for the environment, as well as to lobby and pressure governments for resources and for new policies that help their bottom line.
What about China? What was its role at the conference?
Most people in the U.S., unfortunately, tend to believe, and this is somewhat correctly, actually, that the Chinese, as they've been developing, they generate a tremendous amount of pollution. The moniker is that the Chinese turn on a coal-fired power plant once a week or so. But at the same time, the Chinese are building a green infrastructure of renewable energy, wind energy, solar energy, 10 to 100 times that of the U.S., depending on whose numbers you believe. And so the Chinese are really leading in many of the green sectors. And this is an area that I think American companies, the American government, American people need to be concerned about, because we already have a period in time where the Chinese ostensibly ruled the Earth, and they're on a pathway to do that again, ultimately will be a green and sustainable way. And they were making big strides in the conference. They made commitments that ultimately didn't result because of the way the negotiations went, but they were committing about $500 billion to support new infrastructures on sustainable development. Unfortunately, the commitment to that infrastructure didn't come out of the conference, so the monies won't be produced. So the Chinese are, I think, on the cutting edge of green thinking, green policy making, in the midst of their very serious pollution problems that are real and present, but they're tackling them in a way that I think a lot of American people aren't fully aware of.
They often speak a good line, but they are actually following through on the ground?
Well, it's a mixed record. Again, when you look at investments in wind and solar and renewables broadly, they outspend the U.S. The Chinese government does by a factor of 10 and sometimes as much as maybe 100. And so there is a tremendous amount of green infrastructure. One of the downsides of that is that it's often done in an autocratic, dictatorial way. They don't go through lengthy, democratic environmental review processes like we do in the U.S. They put in efficient high-speed rail lines by moving communities by fiat. So there's tremendous problems because of the lack of democracy and the lack of a democratic approach to building the green future and building a renewable future. But at the same time, we have to pay attention to how they're building their economy and how they're making it a green economy as they grow at the tremendous rates that they grow. And really, we haven't really thought through, I don't think, comprehensively in the U.S., how to deliver on the green economy. We couldn't do it at the multilateral level last week in Brazil. And it doesn't look like there's anybody seriously thinking about how to do things like reduce the overall national commitments in fossil fuels and then simultaneously ramp up commitments in renewables. That, however, was one of the big campaigns of many of the environmental coalitions that were on the ground. That basically, they were launching a campaign that hopefully will play out over the next several years to end subsidies for fossil fuels. So I think that's a good thing. But again, it's not government. We didn't see the leadership to end subsidies for fossil fuels come from Secretary Clinton's State Department. We've seen it come from social movements and organizations, many of whom in the U.S., but many of them are also partnering with groups outside the U.S. because they're not only going to be pressuring the U.S. government to think about this, but they're going to be pressuring multilateral development banks, regional development banks, and so forth.
We're not only not moving away from fossil fuels, we're embracing fracking and offshore drilling with renewed intensity, aren't we?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is the big problem is America has an addiction to oil that it needs to kick. And at a minimum, it needs to begin to plan at a national level, both at the level of government and at the level of the commanding heights of industry, how to get out of our addiction to fossil fuels. And unfortunately, no one in government is putting forward ideas, big ideas, big visionary plans, certainly no one in the White House. But hopefully, maybe they will.
Every now and then you see a report that a certain group of scientists has decided it's really just too late, the climate catastrophe is unfolding, and there's not much we can do about it at this point. What's your reaction to that sort of thing?
Well, I wouldn't say it's too late per se, but the fact is that those on the margins in the U.S. and abroad, low-income, poor communities, do bear the brunt and are bearing the brunt of the unfolding climate catastrophe. You know, colleagues just up in Alaska are negotiating for the relocation of several communities up there. They've been in this process negotiating with the Army Corps of Engineers and with the Environmental Protection Agency and other U.S. agencies and with, of course, the relevant state agencies in Alaska for about the past 5-6 years. That's a story that you almost never hear about unless you're in Alaska and, you know, on the front lines of dealing with it. So we are experiencing the unfolding climate catastrophe before our very eyes. The issue is, when are we going to commit significant resources to get out of ahead of it in a meaningful way and commit significant resources, especially to help those on the margins that are experiencing it right now? And it doesn't look like that's happening. And so the consequences will be that we'll see increased environmental injustice for those on the margins, while those that are essentially not tending to the problem will continue apace.
And finally, what about the politics of this? I mean, it's very hard to get people to care about something that is kind of abstract to them and very long-term when they have very pressing day-to-day worries. And also, you know, you hear things like, it is too late already, so why bother? So you just throw up your hands in despair and carry on. How do you get people really to care about this in a way that matters?
Well, if one thing is the case is that your listeners and other Americans have the ability to be visionary, have the ability to take serious problems on fully and address them. The challenge is with a really corrupt political system, a system that premises mystical thinking almost in terms of there's a whole swathy electorate that doesn't believe really in science and doesn't believe in these unfolding problems. The challenge is how do you navigate that kind of issue with those that are committed to these issues. We know that those that have immediate problems, low-income residents and communities in particular, when we survey those folks, they actually are very much concerned about environmental problems, and they want things to be done on them. And they oftentimes are doing things themselves. So there's a tremendous amount of resiliency. The issue will be having a political fight with not just the forces that aren't leading on the issue, but with forces that like to pretend that there isn't a problem at all. And that's probably going to be the hardest thing. Because I think it's easier to pressure derelict corporations and government agencies that are sort of foot-dragging. It's much more difficult to move entities and individuals and organizations that want to pretend that serious problems don't exist.
That was Michael Dorsey, a professor of environmental studies at Dartmouth College. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Hooligan Rude Boys by the Italian ska-punk band Red Ska. Not sure what the lyrics are saying, except for the antifascista part, but it sounds righteous. Till next week, bye.